accession number 22353, wheel 6.
Warburton and Reel 6. So why was it unpopular to have to deal with VD cases?
Nobody wanted to touch it because this was something which was foreign to them, because they, none of them had not got, had any experience about this. Neither had I, as far as that's concerned. But anyway, there it was, a job to be done, and I did it. After that, I got all the VD cases that came in through. There weren't that many, but all those that did came to me.
And what also, treatment did they get in those days?
Oh, an injection of penicillin was the most that we could do with it in those times, and this was a retention dose. Anything else, I don't think we had much chance of getting anything else going. These were all established cases, and I wanted retention doses. And then, of course, the civilians, I found myself dealing with civilians, always wishing to get... I had a particular sort of... I started to learn the language a bit when we were in Belgium, and that was Flemish. And I thought, well, if I'm going to deal with civilians, I might as well start to learn the language. And so I picked up one or two words, and then, lo and behold, as soon as I'd come round from this four-day business of being unconscious, they said, oh, good, now your clients will be wanting to see you. And so there was a little area at the end of this tent. Well, this tent, it was this workshop. And she set off. And there the people were. And as you know, there was scabies, was a rife situation. People were, particularly civilians, were in difficulty with scabies. And I'd learned enough about it that by that time, but that not if there was one small area left untreated, then it was not possible to produce a satisfactory completion. They wouldn't get better if they had just left one even area, and unless then you resorted to penicillin, using penicillin to get over it. And so lo and behold, on this bench sitting there waiting was a very sort of very smart looking girl. Oh, I don't know what, in her 20s I suppose, and with a very posh grey suit on, and skirt, and she explained that she had this problem, and I was to look at it. So I looked at it, and I said to her, well, are there more of these places on your body? And so she said, yes, there were, but she was rather reluctant to let me see them, and I don't blame her as far as that's concerned. But so I said, well, there's a difficulty. If you went, if you can't show with them, then I must try another way of dealing with the matter. So I went to the MO and said, what a this problem. And could I give her penicillin? So he said, yes. And so I went back to her, and I said to her, I explained to her in my best that I could in Flemish, that it would require me to give her an injection of this particular penicillin. And so she said, oh, that's quite all right. And I said, well, I prefer to do it in your leg. So she said, oh, yes, that's all right. I said, rather high up, I'm afraid. And by this time, there's a great crowd of blokes now on the other side of this screen. And so she said, yes, that would be quite all right. And I indicated to her that, you know, around about here on your thigh and whatnot. So, yeah. And so I went round and on the sort of dispensing side of the screen, and got a swab and a syringe, and got the thing loaded, and then went back. And to my utter surprise, this girl stands bolt upright, draws her skirt right up at her. And a great roar of approval from these chaps behind as I was supposed to steady, very, very steadily swab the area and inject this lady with penicillin, to which she was very grateful, and off she went. I would like to know whether it was successful, because it was enough of an embarrassment for me. I'd never been in such a situation.
Was there some objection to using penicillin for these cases rather than something else?
No, it was the problem. We had normally we had a treatment called benzoate, and that was a sort of a creamy, sticky substance, sort of like a greyish, and you put it on with a shaving brush, and you put it all over the body if it was necessary, if it got that far. And so anyway, that was, and they didn't like. Chaps are very difficult. They could do certain jobs. They could carry stretchers. They could do, but there were a bit. There were limits to which they could normally go to.
But why bother to use that method if you had penicillin?
Well, penicillin was expensive, and we didn't have very much of it, and it was only used in very rare occasions on those days. It was brand new, I mean, on the market, and we were very lucky to get whatever we did of penicillin. It was very, very scarce. And and as far as the treatment, they'd rather, as I said earlier, that if you could do a job, that was yours, you know. And so, like the situation in the same place where in Louvain, when a lady, very, very tall, very, very sort of upright, very well-dressed lady, came, and she said that she showed me a cyst that she had in her forehead. And I said, what could I do for her? And she said, I want this taken out. And so I said, but madam, you've had it for a long time. And so she said, I want it out. And I said, well, there's you could hear bombs around, you know, and I said, well, there's a war on type of thing, you know. You're a medical unit? I said, yes. And so she said, right, I want it out, now. And I said, well, I must seek advice about this. And so I went back, saw Jock Bremner, who was a wonderful man, and he said, oh, we'll have to take it out of here then, won't we? I said, where? He said, take it out in the middle of the field. So I said, what's he going to sit on? Well, we're going to one of the nearest houses and borrow a chair. And so there it was, in the middle of a field, with this dear lady sitting on a chair. Well, Jock Bremner gave her a local anaesthetic and removed this cyst. She went home, we dressed it, of course, and she went home quite happy. She was as happy as a sandboy. She'd got this development on her forehead removed. She was satisfied. And so that's the daily work that I had to do at Louvain. And that was the beginning, really, of the Market Garden operation, because it was from there that we were to go and make our way up Hell's Highway. Because we gathered ourselves together and we joined the convoy. And as you know, it went up through Eindhoven and Grave and whatever, up to Nijmegen. The road itself was only two vehicles wide. You know, you could get two vehicles passing, as it were. And either side was either swamp or it was, well, it was unstable ground. And so anybody that ventured off was in trouble. And we had some 7 bridges to cross before we could get to Arnhem. And so that is where the beginning of the Arnhem operation began. We went up and took up our position in this convoy, but we were not operational as such, as a medical unit, we weren't. But we had to be up front with the... We were attached to the 129 Infantry Brigade, and so therefore we had to be up with them as far as that was concerned. Our position had to be relative to that situation. And, of course, the difficulties were when we discovered that the panzers were already ready for us at whatever bridge we came to, and we had to fight for every bridge, mainly using tanks and the armoured vehicles, which were obviously taking the brunt of all this fighting. The infantry, they used there was a breakout and a break in, or a break in and a breakout. Break in was the tanks and armoured vehicles would go in, form an opening. The infantry would be close behind and walking behind them sometimes to break out in so the bridgehead was developed, as it were. And this is the way it did it. But it was very, very difficult in the, and so they chose to fight for every bridge that we went over. And so it meant also that our line of the single road was cut every night. And question of rations and things like that. Sometimes we were eating German rations, and I take it that sometimes they were eating ours. I don't know. I think that was the answer. But it was a very difficult route up there, and of course it was expiring our supply of ammunition and things of that nature, because the more it took to get the next bridge, took more and more to capture, and more ammunition was being used. And so we progressed slowly up the road. We all knew that there was a target, and that we had got to get to this situation as Arnhem. But there's nothing we can do about it except fight our way forward, and fight it was. There was the odd occasion where there was a draw-off, as it were. You get off the road, and we did, in fact, get off on one occasion, and we were standing with our vehicle off the road, and a bit of a copse, and then a wide field beyond that, and we were standing in a circle, as it were, just the 15 of us, behind the lorry, chatting away, and I heard this gun, pop of the gun, fire, which was obviously a sniper's fire, and the chappie that I was next to me fell to the ground. He was an RSC, he was the RSC batman, of the batman driver of the medical officer. And so that was very sad, really. And it was a sort of traumatic situation, really, to have it be so close. And you don't really expect that sort of thing to happen. And it didn't upset any, well, I can't remember except upsetting any others, except the MO. And he didn't show any signs of it, but later on it came out in very vividly. And he was a chap named Lishman, and he was very upset by it. And and he proved that when we got to a place called Lüneburg. much later on.
How did his distress manifest itself?
He found, when we were at a place in Indenburg, opposite there were some cottages, and they were having a birthday celebration or whatever, and he flew down this side. We had a hospital in a school which had a wide staircases, and he flew down these wide staircases, which was all glass screen on the outside wall, and across there, and burst through the door, bashed their heads together. It was dreadful to see a man, and he was a rugby player, so you can imagine what sort of quietness became over the place.
But did you know it was related to the loss of the Batman?
Well, I think that he was, because he was always upset about this situation. And it didn't seem to be a situation that he could get out of his system. Eventually, of course, we did arrive at Nijmegen. Nothing very, apart from the action that took place up the road and preparing the way for us to get through was all to do with the tanks and the artillery and things of that nature. Nothing much else that anybody could do. Perhaps the few infantry who were right up front to try and break through. But we had no casualties come through to us, and we, in fact, we were on wheels all the time. And on the Thursday morning, we arrived in Nijmegen, and in a street of normal houses, very sort of semi-detached houses on both sides, very suburban place, as it were. But it was to prove significant as far as I was concerned. And we were in there in the morning, and people were very pleased to see us, obviously. And obviously the other thing about it is that they didn't know whether it was a flux type of situation, that we would be there, got in, then maybe pushed out. We weren't being pushed out. And so we, in the afternoon, we were going over the bridge to a place called Lent. And that was, you go over the bridge, and you go about 500 yards, and there's a turning to the right, and that's towards this little village called Lent. And we took up a position in an orchard. And as we went over the bridge, I was really amazed to see that the Germans were still strapped to the girders. They were obviously up there to fight for their way, rear guard action, I suppose. But anyway, there they were, all dead, of course. But there are other people that I know who were going over the bridge at the same time, and they remember similarly these people strapped up to the girders of the bridge. The bridge is bow-shaped, as the main bridges were in Holland. The two things happened in Lent of particular importance was that we got the tented up, and I was just now boiling up on the steriliser, boiling up for to commence operations, when ammonium mini, as they were called, they were a particular type of shell that had a moan about it as it went along, and it go wobbling and whatever, and it came through one side of this tented, and out through the other, and I was taking up a defensive position, as it were, underneath this table, which was about 10 feet away. And I have mentioned since about this experience, and they all said to me that anybody who'd been that close to a moaning mini knows what it feels like. And so it's that was the one thing that happened there. And but night was falling rather fast, and and we only had very small dim lights to work with. And so finally we got it ready, and there's still no casualties, etc., for us. So we decided to bed down, as it were. But only to be wakened up in the early hours of the morning, about 2 o'clock, or thereabouts, to say, get up, get this lot packed up, get out of here. They're only 200 yards down the road. We were a bit too close to the front line, actually. And so in our best as we could, we got ourselves packed up again, and we were out. So they took us back to into Nomagan, to the main body. And they were on the football ground. And so they, it was now into Thursday, Friday. And so we, Friday was spent, and Saturday was spent in sort of more or less waiting for things to happen, I suppose, really, in readiness, waiting to move on. And but they decided that they would all spread themselves around in this field. They get quite accustomed and quite blasé to now to all the shell fire that they could hear and all the rest of it. And and so they were spread around, and about 20 planes started approaching, and they said, "Oh, it's all right, they're all ours, there aren't any Germans around." But there were. And these were, in fact, German planes, the only German planes that we'd seen from the time of landing in Normandy. And they came down and did a bit of rapid fire, machine gunning, and then moved off. So I don't know, they didn't do anything, any damage to any of us or our vehicles or our, but they certainly came down so that they weren't ours, they were the other side. But that was the only time that we saw any airplanes of the Germans. And so it came eventually to Sunday, and they decided that they were going to have a football match, and on a Sunday, Sunday being the important thing as far as I was concerned, and that wasn't in my in my brief as a sort of a Christian. I thought, no, I must not. I've been well looked after, and I'm not going to do that. So I said to him, I'm not playing football. I'm going for a walk. Now, that's a bit of a dangerous thing to do. But on the other hand, as far as I could see, there was no danger in it. And for some unknown reason, I don't know, but I took a particular route, and I thought, well, if you go down here, you turn left, and you turn left, and you turn left, and you'll come back to the same position. So I'll be careful not to get myself disorientated. So I went down, and I turned left, as it were, and I started to walk up this road, and I thought, well, this road looks familiar. And then I thought again, well, I'm sure it's the road that we were coming up on Thursday, when we stopped and had a cup of tea and whatnot, you know, brewed up by the side of the road. And there was nobody, not a soul in this road at all. And I'd gone about halfway up the road, and I thought, well, I don't know. I'm not too sure whether I should carry on or whether I should turn back and go back to the football ground anyway. And a lady turned a corner up the road, turned a corner on a bicycle, and she was on a bicycle, and she came down, and she She stopped and said, "Could you help me?" So I said, "Yes. Could you tell me where the Salvation Army Hall was?" "Oh," she said, "no, I can't really." "In any case," she said, it was shut down by Hitler. And in fact, it was just destroyed by fire. I said, "Well, I'm very sorry to hear that, because I would like to have met the Salvation Army officers." So she said, "Well, if you'd like to come into this house with me, that's where I'm going, across the road here, you'll find Salvation Army officers." And I went in, and it was amazing. There they were, they were holding a service, and they, etc., just a house full of people. And they opened a tin of biscuits, which they'd been saving for a special occasion, and we had tea and biscuits in this house. I thought that was a remarkable piece of, well, it was a remarkable experience, and a sign that I was on the right track. And that was quite something. And I went back eventually to the football ground. I think they escorted me to the football ground to make sure I got back safely there. And it's always remained with me as a very important situation that I experienced in Nijmegen. So the next movement that we made was then going to sort of regroup again in a place just outside Nijmegen, and I've never been able to find, remember the name of it, but it was another church, and it was another area which had joined the church, and there we sort of had this tentage up, and two or three of our chaps were, there's all some idiots, well, I suppose, they don't see the danger in what they're doing until it's too late. And they were in this orchard, they were throwing apples through the, we had, there were windows in this tentage, which you could run down a cover to and pressed on it in position, but it was up on this day, and they were throwing things out, and I said to them, you should not do that. And then sort of one of them stopped an apple in his eye, tore his eye, which was very sad. And so anyway, it was obvious that we got to send him back into the nearest hospital that we could, which is now in Nijmegen. And we had to make a ticket out, of course, a label which goes in an envelope which is attached to the injured person. And so I think you better let me make that out. And so it was made out. And hopefully, but nobody suspected anything. What I do know is that years later I met the man in Burton-on-Trent, and he said, "Thank you very much. I got a pension as a result of what you did." And all I did was to describe it, but he, in drawing the darkness, that he bent down in the orchard and a twig went in his eye. And it's another sort of little incident that stays with me a long time. But Frankie was a nice chap, and of course we didn't see him again. He went back to base, and he went back home to England, etc. The movement of the war in that area then began to change, because it was obvious we weren't going to be able to go straight up, which is the direct route to Arnhem, which is about 10 miles. And because there was now a great panzer division, two divisions in fact, had been, one had been making two out of one type of thing, cannibalising their tanks to make good ones, etc. And they were doing them just up the road from there, not very far off anyway. And so round about the Ustabik area, and so they were all ready for us, and that it was one of the biggest problems that we'd had, and one of the biggest mistakes we had. Some of the